This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, the chair of Western Michigan University's psychology department, Stephanie Peterson, who also serves as co-investigator for Western's Autism Center for Excellence. But first, the loss of manufacturing jobs was an issue that Bernie Sanders used to argue against globalization during his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2016. President Trump called for better trade deals during his campaign. What are the causes of that decline in manufacturing employment? A report called Understanding the Decline of U.S. Manufacturing Employment has been published by the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo. Vice President and Director of Research Susan Hausman authored that report. She also made a presentation on the findings January 12th at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Susan Hausman, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
If we're sitting here now talking in 2018, how would we describe the state of manufacturing in the United States?
Well, I would say that it would be certainly much weaker than it has been in the past. And let me just kind of back up and go through really what underlay that debate during the 2016 presidential campaign with Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump saying, you know, we need to bring manufacturing jobs back. What was to bring back? You know, historically, manufacturing employment had grown until the late 1970s. We experienced some pretty significant declines in the 1980s. Those were concentrated in a couple of industries, though, steel and textiles and apparel. And after that, manufacturing employment was pretty stable up until 2000. And then, as some people described it, manufacturing employment in this country just collapsed. Between 2000 and 2007, we lost 3.4 million jobs, roughly 20% of our employment base. And then the Great Recession hit. We lost on net another 1.5 million jobs. So employment in manufacturing crashed again. And we saw a little bit of recovery, but not very much. So on balance, between 2000 and now, we've lost almost 5 million jobs, or put it another way, close to 30% of our manufacturing base. That decline was historically unprecedented. We've never seen anything like that before. And at the same time, we lost nearly 22% of our factories.
So this was a time which, as you say, is historically unprecedented for an industry which does have some fluctuation due to the economy. So if we're looking for structural changes which might have led to these jobs being lost, what are some things we might look at?
That's a good point, that manufacturing is very cyclically sensitive. So what we see when we go into a recession is typically manufacturing does shed a lot of jobs, but they usually come right back afterwards. The early 2000 recession that took place in 2001 and 2002 was the first time that manufacturing jobs didn't come back. They just kept dropping steadily. In terms of your question, what structural changes might have underlay the decline, you know, there's a debate that you led with in your opening. During the presidential campaign, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump blamed trade. You know, by and large, they said trade is the cause of this collapse in manufacturing employment, and we should be very concerned, and we should try to bring the jobs back. And what evidence do they have to point to trade? Well, actually, there's a fair amount of just, you know, facts lining up that would suggest that trade, if not the only factor, played a big role.
Well, give us some examples of some things that tell us that, yes, trade has caused a drop in manufacturing employment in the United States.
In the early 2000s, the dollar sharply appreciated. And so that makes our manufactured goods more expensive relative to other countries. Many people also point to China's accession to the World Trade Organization. At the same time, we saw a wave of low-cost imports from other countries, primarily from China. We saw very weak export growth. And you put those two together, and you've got a soaring trade deficit. During this period of time, we're still running a quite large trade deficit. So all of those facts point to at least some significant role played by trade.
What about some other factors that might play into this, or at least that we have heard might play into this? For instance, automation. Could automation be replacing human workers with robots and therefore fewer people are working in manufacturing?
Right. So for sure, automation is occurring in manufacturing. It's probably, it is an important phenomenon. On the other side of the debate, some of my fellow economists have gone out and said, you know, we're really sorry that all these people lost their jobs. But you've got the story wrong. It's really all about automation, or primarily about automation. Trade, in fact, played a very small role. So what's the basis for that statement? Now, what they're doing is that they're looking primarily, fundamentally, they're looking at official statistics on manufacturing that show that when you adjust for inflation, output growth in manufacturing has pretty much kept pace with output growth of the aggregate economy of the private sector. So from that perspective, it looks like manufacturing is just doing great. We're doing fine, no problem at all. And if manufacturing output has been so strong, but it's shedding a lot of jobs, that just means, it just translates into extraordinarily high productivity growth. And so many economists and policy analysts and so forth put those two things together and said, well, the high productivity growth and the very robust output growth, once you control for inflation, must just be picking up automation. And so it's automation that's causing these job declines. And at that point, they start making lots of analogies to agriculture, where indeed that did happen. There was, you know, things were automated and employment, very few people work on farms anymore.
One of the things you detail in your report is how the computer industry and sales related to that have helped skew these numbers. Try to put it, I suppose, in a way that the non-economists in our audience can understand.
Right. So this story, let me just kind of say one more thing before I get into the weeds on the computer industry. But this story got translated in mainstream media. You know, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, even our friends at NPR pretty routinely reported that our president and Bernie Sanders and many others had gotten the story wrong, that there was nothing to revive in manufacturing because it was doing just great. The problem with the automation story and using these sort of basic government statistics to rest your argument on the automation story is it turns out that there is one relatively small industry that you've already mentioned. It's called computer and electronic products. The key products in there are computers and semiconductors. They only account for 13% of value added in the manufacturing sector, but they pack a rather large punch. The reason is that the statistical agencies make some adjustments to output growth in computers and semiconductors to take into account or try to take into account the extraordinary improvements in those products. Think of Moore's law in semiconductors, where sort of the amount of information that you can put on a chip has just grown exponentially. Think of the computer that you buy this year might be, in some sense, have the same power or functionality of two or three computers 5 years ago. So the statistical agencies try to make adjustments for those quality improvements, and it turns out they're very, very large. So the computer and electronics products industries, when adjusted for inflation, is growing at an extraordinary rate, and it just pulls up the rest of the sector's numbers. It really largely accounts for the apparent robust growth in manufacturing output and in productivity.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. I'm speaking with Susan Hausman. She is Vice President and Director of Research for the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. She is also the author of a report on the decline of manufacturing jobs in the United States.
When you take out the computer industry from the manufacturing statistics, output growth and productivity growth in manufacturing really dives. So, for example, it was largely keeping pace with the aggregate economy from the late 1970s to 2000, but it drops by over half when you take out that sector. If you take out computers in the 2000s, you see that manufacturing output growth is just flat. There's virtually no growth. And in fact, when you take it out since 2007, right before the Great Recession, output is actually lower in the rest of manufacturing than here. So that paints a picture of a pretty weak sector in the United States, getting back to your original question.
So a weak manufacturing sector for the United States, obviously for people who work in manufacturing, that's distressing news. What should it mean for the rest of us who don't necessarily have a dog in that fight? Is there a bigger impact on the overall economy that we should be worried about?
Sure. Well, you know, some people will say, look, only 9% of the workforce is counted in manufacturing now. So in some sense, it doesn't have a big effect on the aggregate economy. But it actually packs a much bigger punch than one might suspect just looking at those data. When I say we lost 5 million jobs in manufacturing, that's just in manufacturing. Manufacturing has very deep supply chains. Much of the work, roughly half of people who work in that supply chain, are actually employed in services. For example, you might go into a plant in the auto industry, say an auto supplier, and it wouldn't be uncommon to find 20 to 30% of the people on the line employed through a temporary help agency. The firms might outsource much or all of their repair and maintenance. They might outsource some or all of their transportation and logistics. They might even pull in some contractors who are engineers and scientists to help out on special projects. All of that is fairly common. So that immediately when a factory closes or whatever, there's a mass layoff, it affects a lot more people in that regional economy very directly than just the workers who are counted as losing their jobs in manufacturing.
You say in the conclusion of your paper that a discussion of trade policies is beyond the scope of what you're researching. But we obviously have to talk a little bit about trade here. And I guess the first big question is, do you think that these findings indicate that, yes, there is something that can be done that could bring manufacturing jobs back?
That's a really tough question. I'm sympathetic to the argument that it will be hard to bring manufacturing jobs back. And it's not just because, the standard line is because they've been automated out. Companies set up their factories overseas or foreign companies set up overseas, they establish supply chains, they develop expertise, and in the meantime, you've lost it. And it's hard to bring it back. So that's a challenge. On the other hand, there's still quite a lot of manufacturing that we do in the United States, and there's reasons to there's opportunities to grow that and possibly bring some of it back.
So even if we're just now going to focus on the idea of retaining the manufacturing jobs that we do have, and again, recognizing that trade policy is a bit beyond what you were talking about here, but is it now important that we have that conversation about the pros and cons of reopening trade agreements, of a tougher trade policy? Are those things that now need to be more front and center in the debate if we're going to talk about how to retain and perhaps create more manufacturing jobs?
Sure. Well, many things, including trade agreements, affect the competitiveness of domestic manufacturing. So there's, how you structure your trade agreements, and that includes tariffs, non-tariff barriers, and all the things the president has been focusing on. It also, other things that affect it are, the tax structure in companies. And we've just seen a tax overhaul that cut the corporate taxes, tax rate. And the stated reason for doing that was that the United States wasn't competitive and the companies were expanding overseas to lower their taxes. So perhaps that will have a positive effect. Another very important factor is the exchange rate. the dollar, most people acknowledge, was overvalued in the early 2000s. And if the dollar is strong, it just makes you less competitive. It makes domestic manufacturers less competitive in global markets and encourages more imports. So exchange rate policies are terribly important. It's important not to have an overvalued dollar.
Susan Hausman is Vice President and Director of Research for the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
A link to Susan Hausman's research paper on the decline in manufacturing employment can be found at upjohn.org. There's also a link available at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. In the fall of 2016, a new home opened for the Kalamazoo Autism Center, part of Western Michigan University's Autism Center for Excellence. It offers treatment for children and young adults. Stephanie Peterson is the chair of Western Psychology Department. She's also co-investigator for the Autism Center for Excellence. A discovery symposium on autism will be presented on Friday, February 23rd, as part of Western Michigan University's spring convocation. Stephanie Peterson, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So first of all, give people an idea if they don't know, if they haven't heard of, or maybe have heard a little bit about the Autism Center for Excellence. What does it do?
Well, the Autism Center for Excellence is really an umbrella for a lot of different services that we're providing. And the overarching goal is to make lives better for individuals with autism. And we hope to do that across the lifespan, not just for young children, but for young children all the way through the lifespan.
So I mentioned the Kalamazoo Autism Center, mm-hmm. which opened its new home back in the fall of 2016. What are some other things that the Autism Center for Excellence does?
Well, in addition to the Kalamazoo Autism Center, we also offer a service here on Western Michigan University's campus called the Autism Services Center. And it's a service that we provide to college students who have autism, and actually any student on campus can access it, but it was first developed for individuals with autism. And we provide services there sort of above and beyond the services that are typically offered for people through the Americans with Disabilities Act. So, you know, above and beyond sort of extra testing time and things like that, we offer things like social skills groups to help individuals learn social skills. Sometimes Courtney Bacallier, who's the director of that, will actually like attend a lab with a student if they're having difficulty sort of with the personal interactions that have to occur there. Buddy systems with other students here on campus. So we found that to be very successful in helping students be more comfortable on campus, get along in their dorm settings, and graduate. So that's one. Another one we offer is something called Promotes. And Promotes is actually for young adults also, but it's a job placement service. So we're helping young people sort of age 16 and up identify areas that they want to work in and helping them carve out jobs that they might be successful in, and then offering job coaching to help them be more successful. Because I don't know if you know, but the employment rate for individuals with autism and other developmental disabilities is very, very low. So we're trying to change that. Those are some of the primary other services we're offering than the Kalamazoo Autism Center, but at the same time, our department continues to offer a wide range of training programs for undergraduate and graduate students in the area, and that's sort of embedded in all the activities we do.
Now, I want to go back to something you said in your answer about the services on campus, that any student can seek these out.
Yes.
Does that happen very often, or is it mostly or overwhelmingly students who are autistic and know that they have some form of autism who will seek services out on campus?
Yeah, right now it's overwhelmingly people with autism. We have had some individuals contact us with interest in it who don't have autism, their children don't have autism, but who may need some extra supports and who've shown interest. So we're hoping over time that it sort of grows into that area a little more. Part of my goal there, and I think Courtney's, is that people with autism aren't sort of like stigmatized that they need these extra services, that there's lots of people who need extra support sometimes at college. And so we sort of want to be there for that as well.
And then the Kalamazoo Autism Center, opened since the fall of 2016. What has this been providing, and is it filling a need in the Kalamazoo area that has been there for a while but maybe wasn't being met?
Yes. So the center serves children anywhere from, I think our youngest child is about 2 years old right now, and the oldest person coming to our center right now is about 15. We hope to go up even higher than that, but at this point, that's the age range we're serving. So we have young children who come there during the what traditionally we'd think of as the school day, some as many as 40 hours a week, to receive very intensive services to help them develop their language skills, their self-care skills. We do a lot of toilet training for children, and hopefully get them ready to go to school and be able to participate as fully as possible at school. Then we have school-age children who will come after school and receive some additional services in either language development or also self-care skills. We also work with a lot of individuals who have pretty significant behavioral issues, so we try to help in reducing those behaviors and replacing them with more appropriate behaviors. So we're constantly looking to expand those services as well. I think we're serving about 20 children, 20 to 24 children out there right now. We're starting to run out of space. So I think that indicates we're filling a need that maybe was always there but didn't exist before. Maybe soon we'll have to look to expand, but we're doing pretty well right now. We accept both insurance and Medicaid as payment, so we have a variety of different children and different needs there.
If we were to look back, say 20, 25 years ago, would we see that a lot of the things being offered at the Kalamazoo Autism Center did not exist for children with autism? That there were services out there, but there has been an evolution in terms of the understanding of what children need, depending on, their age and depending on cognitive abilities, those sort of things?
Absolutely. I mean, back before 1975, children who had disabilities weren't even educated in our public school system. So many of these services did not exist at all back then. And then as the children with disabilities started entering the school system, a lot of people weren't quite sure what to do with them. We were really fortunate, I think, here in Kalamazoo to have the psychology department at Western. We have a 50-year history of behavior analysis, and Dr. Dick Malott actually partnered with, back then it was Croydon Avenue School through KRESA, and has had a preschool program out there where they've implemented some of these behavioral interventions for young children with autism. I think they're probably going on 25 years of offering that, and they're still offering it today, even alongside the other activities we're doing. But that's what really built the foundation for a lot of the research in how to intervene for children with autism. And behavior analysis has been found to be one of the only evidence-based treatments for children with autism. So, yeah, the landscape looked a lot different. But I would say those who lived here in Kalamazoo had a little hidden gem over at Croydon Avenue School that not many other people had. So we've been very fortunate there. Unfortunately, as soon as those kids finished preschool, they didn't have access to that anymore. And so that's the piece that the Kalamazoo Autism Center is providing now that really did not exist around here before.
So as I mentioned, you are co-investigator for the Autism Center for Excellence. Mm-hmm. Is that some of the things you investigate? are the research that's out there regarding autism?
Yes. So I'm the co-investigator. Dr. Wayne Fuqua helped write the original grant proposal that sort of got all this going. But I should mention many of my colleagues are engaged in this. Dr. Dick Malott, Dr. Kelly Kohler, Dr. Jessica Frieder, just to name a few. And all of us have interest in children with autism and developmental disabilities. So between all of us, we're conducting research on a variety of interventions where Dr. Malott tends to focus on early intervention. Jessica Frieder tends to focus more on school-age kids, and she's doing the Promotes Project with the employment. My lab tends to focus on dealing with children who have very severe behavior problems and how we reduce those. And then Wayne Fuqua has interests more in policy development. So we all work together very collaboratively to make all the pieces happen.
Are you finding that new programs are being developed routinely now, that you're finding that there's another area of need and therefore we need to do X?
Sure. You know, I think the area we probably know the most about is helping very young children with autism. We're pretty good with a lot of the language development stuff and the early skills that children need to learn. And we have a little bit of a handle on severe behavior problems due to some work of some of my former colleagues, like Dr. Brian Iwata, who used to be a faculty member here. So that we've had some good developments in those areas. I think the areas where we still struggle a lot are with young adults, high school children who maybe are struggling more with their social skills and peer relationships and what historically we may have called more high-functioning kids with autism. I think we still struggle a little bit with what are the best interventions for those folks and how do we get them to be successful in employment situations and college situations. And it's the area where we probably have the most limited research. So that's one of the reasons we've tried to target that area as well as the young children, because it's an area we really still need to grow a lot in.
Do you see another area out there right now? You mentioned, you know, older children was something that you think needs a little more focus. Is there something else, that another program where some more research really seems to be warranted, that maybe some new ideas for programs could really fill a need?
Yeah, I think there's a couple areas that I'd like to see more development in. One is how we as behavior analysts sort of collaborate best with the school system. Sometimes right now what you will see is sort of a disconnect between what's happening at school and then the services that a child might be receiving at a center like ours. And then, of course, you've got the home environment. So somehow you've got and that child operates in all those different environments. And so finding a way to make sure that the services are well connected and well integrated across those different settings so that the child gets the best service possible. And I think, you know, schools are struggling a lot with all of the pressures that are put on them and the diversity of children that they're asked to deal with and the lack of funding that they have. So ensuring that we have really high quality service in school systems, I think, is an area that is probably always going to be something we struggle with. I think the other area that I'm personally interested in is, what about those children who are out in more rural areas who don't have access to a university nearby that has a center like ours and has a child maybe with some significant needs and challenges, and yet there aren't many providers nearby? Like, how do we best serve those individuals? And one area that my lab has sort of begun to investigate is the use of computer technologies and what we call teleconsultation or telemedicine, where we used web-based services to actually, I'm going to put this in air quotes, Skype into we don't use Skype because it's not, doesn't have compliance for confidentiality of, you know,
okay, right.
Web stuff. So we use other service providers, but you get the idea.
Right.
And we basically will kind of Skype into a parent's living room, for example, and help them conduct an evaluation of their child's problem behavior. Or I have other colleagues who are using those kinds of technologies to actually coach parents to implement the early intensive behavior intervention services if there aren't other providers around. And I think there's a lot of promise in the technologies that we have available, and we just haven't really explored or studied their utility enough yet.
Stephanie Peterson is the chair of Western Michigan University's Psychology Department, also co-investigator of Western's Center for Autism Excellence. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
A discovery symposium on autism will be presented on Friday, February 23rd, as part of Western Michigan University's spring convocation. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.